youth-mental-health-I think campaign, right? And I would encourage people to look at that 9888 website, which I mentioned before, 988oregon.org. And please take a look at the Hold On campaign website. We have internationally award-winning songs on suicide prevention. And music is something too that if a song might appeal to you, you can listen to that, right? 24/7. And it can strengthen you to have hope and to seek the help and the life that you deserve.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kaufman. I really appreciate your time and you sharing experiences and your words. Anything else?
And the song Hold On to Tomorrow, which you're soon going to be hearing, features the beautiful voice of Dustin Paul and the magnificent work of James Mano, who's the producer.
In the silence of the night, when we feel so all alone, violent strings cry out in memory, stories left untold. In the shadow of heartache, souls lost in despair. The cello sings of sorrow, each note a heavy weight. Symphony of heartache, a dance with grief. Yet even in darkest times, life's spirit yearns to be. Hold on to tomorrow, even when it's hard to see. You're not alone in this life, Lord's hope will set you free.
You've been listening to an interview with Dr. Kaufman, the head of Create Resilience Youth Art Contest for Suicide Prevention. To play us out is Dr. Kaufman's song, Hold On to Tomorrow. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Hannah Francis.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the Best in Jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dot.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got four requests for this thing already today. Strutting right with it.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Laura Wadlin, here with my co-host, Jamie Partridge. Hey, Jamie.
Hey, Laura.
Tonight, our guest is Hunter Bwen, a bass player who is an organizer for the American Federation of Musicians, Local 99. Welcome, Hunter.
Hey, Laura. Thanks for having me.
The Musicians Union has traditionally organized large groups of musicians with regular employment, such as orchestra and studio musicians. Hunter is additionally working to organize club musicians, a project which is especially difficult because of the instability and competitive nature of the club scene. Hunter, please give us a history of the Portland club scene, the Musicians Union, and especially past attempts to organize club musicians.
Yes, of course. So our traditional organizing targets were actually not orchestral and studio musicians. We at one time represented musicians in all forms of work, including in bars and in clubs. This focus that you're describing on orchestral symphonic and theatrical is really a post-1980s phenomenon, actually. It was a response to changes in law, actually. So what we often refer to as the club and casual scene, which means bars, clubs, restaurants, hotels, and the like, has actually been very stagnant for a long time since the 1980s in terms of pay and protections for working musicians, because before 1979, these musicians played much more regularly at their respective club or bar. But most importantly, they were considered employees at that time. So this means they had employment protections, they paid into unemployment, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid taxes, all of that stuff that comes with being an employee. And most importantly of those things is that they had the right to organize and collectively bargain, just like in any other form of work. There were two circuit court decisions in the early 1980s, one of which was launched by Hilton San Juan against the NLRB. And essentially, the effect is that it made all club and casual musicians independent contractors without any right to organize or collectively bargain for a union in those workplaces. Instead, they considered them employed by their band leader and not by the actual institution that hired them. So AFM, at one point, was actually one of the largest unions in the nation. And prior to these decisions, we had about 300,000 members at our peak. But after this, our membership was basically slashed dramatically, effectively overnight, as a result of these pieces of legislation. So I'm certain every industry has a story like this, where conservative anti-union legislation caused irreparable damage to the ranks and to membership. Think Janus for the public sector, for example. But specifically for musicians, this was a death knell for forward progress in club and casual work, because it took rights away directly from so many musicians. So if you ask a club musician who's been playing in the club scene since the 1970s, they'll likely tell you that wages are basically the same as they were back then, not accounting for inflation, right? Because nothing has changed in that industry because there's a lack of collective bargaining rights. We're all aware that labor law in this country is shoddy, to say the least, but this is just yet another example of that same phenomenon. So since then, since the 1980s, we have had something of a focus on orchestral, symphonic, and theatrical musicians, mostly as a response to those changes. But we still have big ambitions to organize in the freelance scene, even today.
So can you talk a little bit about what's happened to trying to organize freelancers since the 1980s here in Portland?
Yeah, so there's been various attempts to try to revive that same kind of scene. Fair Trade Music, which we'll talk about in a moment, being one of the most important of them. There's been sporadic movements over the decades to bring freelancers together in some sense for better pay, for better working conditions, but there's never been much staying power. It takes a lot of solidarity in a very hyper-competitive environment. As we mentioned, it's very competitive, it's very hyper-individualistic, a term that I use often to describe the freelance industry. Often people don't view other musicians that play alongside them as coworkers, but rather as competition. And it's very ripe for exploitation. So attempts to organize in the freelance scene have been sporadic over the years, but I'd be happy to talk more about freelance organizing in terms of Fair Trade Music and what the expo hopes to bring.
The union is sponsoring a Portland Music Resiliency Expo on September 9th at the Musicians Union Hall. What is happening now in the Portland music scene that inspired you to organize this gathering?
Yeah, so this is going to require a little bit of background, and some of you listeners may know about this, so bear with me. Live Nation is perhaps the largest live entertainment company on the planet, And in 2010, they merged with Ticketmaster, consolidating another aspect of this industry, ticket sales. And through this, they've become incredibly controversial for price gouging consumers. Maybe you've heard about it. The point of this action and many of their other actions is to achieve control over every possible profit-making mechanism in the course of curating live music. And they've largely achieved that goal, I would argue. Something that they have a reputation for is entering into local music scenes. In Texas, for example, they've done this, and elsewhere, where they enter into it and essentially decimate it from within using anti-consumer and monopolistic practices that center themselves as the one and only music production company in town, effectively. And they've done this in the past by having musicians sign non-compete agreements. So that basically, if you play for a Live Nation venue, you're not allowed to play anywhere else for a substantial period of time and anywhere else in a very large 100-mile plus radius. And because they pay so handsomely and it's a really, really good gig, it's hard to say no. It's hard for musicians to say no to that type of gig, but it cuts them out of playing anywhere else. In addition to that, they've also been known to section off their very large venues that they build from several thousand seats to half of that to a quarter of that in order to directly compete with smaller local venues that are around their major venue. So effectively, they use their status and their massive wealth to cause smaller venues to close their doors, to literally shut down. And in 2024, there was an investigation launched by the Biden administration's Department of Justice alongside 29 states in the country that was supposed to investigate their anti-competitive practices. I don't know what the status of that investigation is, but More Perfect Union has a magnificent piece on Live Nation and their practices on YouTube. So listeners can check that out if they haven't. So needless to say, Portland's music ecosystem was not very happy when we heard that Live Nation wanted to get a land use permit to build a major venue here in town. On top of how controversial they are, they wanted to build it in a very odd place logistically, along the water in Southeast Industrial, where the nearest bus stop would have been up a flight of stairs on the Morrison Bridge. And you can obviously see an ADA issue with that. There were so many other logistical issues there. So enter Music Portland, which is a local music advocacy nonprofit that brought a bunch of people together to protest their land use permit just some months ago now. And they got dozens of musicians and local venue owners or advocates to speak at city council to protest this prior to the changeover to the new city council. And I was there, in fact, but we were ultimately unsuccessful in the face of a multi-billion dollar corporation, obviously. So they are coming to town, despite our best efforts. And AEG is a similar music business that plans to build another venue in the former Lloyd Center Nordstrom. Maybe you've heard about it. Their reputation as AEG is not nearly as bad as Live Nation, but it is a massive live entertainment company. And so what we can do as musicians here in Portland is, with people power, demand that these companies adhere to at least some guidelines to try not to repeat the devastation that resulted in the entrance into other cities from their past. Portland has been a haven for independent artists and independent musicians for such a long time, and we have a lot of pride in that fact. And so we hope that the expo can be kind of a launching pad to get people involved in making the music scene a better place off of the back of, you know, these big changes coming to town soon.
So you mentioned one of the campaigns that you've helped organize called Fair Trade Music. And so what is Fair Trade Music, and how has it worked in places like Seattle, and how is it going here in Portland?
Yes, Fair Trade Music is a very exciting subject for our union. It began here in Portland under our previous president, Bruce Fife. It started about 15 years ago, and it was a direct response to the lack of collective bargaining rights in club and casual work. So Fair Trade Music was proposed as sort of a social contract, if you will, with venues in place of a collective bargaining agreement. So here's the deal. A venue agrees in writing to treat musicians fairly in the course of their work. This means decent pay based on the size and the capacity of the venue, and also transparency on how that pay is calculated. And this is huge because the way that musicians get paid varies so much gig to gig. Sometimes it's bar sales, sometimes it's door sales, sometimes it's only a percentage of bar. or door sales, and sometimes musicians are asked to pay the sound engineer and the light person before they're able to take home any money. Some of them end up in the negative sometimes. So essentially, what it's asking for is fair dealing between musicians and venues. In exchange, these venues can publicly advertise and label themselves as fair trade music venues in much the same way that you would label fair trade coffee, right? No exploitation in the procurement of this work. That's the point. The hope is that with a lot of musician and consumer education on what this label means, that you can put real stock into that label and that venues can be really proud to treat musicians with dignity and respect, since their reputation, especially in Portland, goes a very long way. In Portland specifically, the last time we tried to organize around fair trade music, we almost got it all the way there. McMinimins had actually agreed to be the first set of venues to sign on to this project. But unfortunately, we actually ran into issues with solidarity among musicians and lost a lot of our momentum. And since then, the campaign has been dormant. As you mentioned, Jamie, fair trade music is somewhat successful in other cities, in Texas and up in Seattle and Washington, of course. And it's something that our union still has a lot of interest in. And we hope that at the expo, we're going to be hosting a table for fair trade music. And we really want to spark those conversations again, because we think we've really learned from some of those past mistakes of fair trade music. And we think it still has so much value, especially here in Portland. So we really want to see it come back to life.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Labor Radio, KBOO Portland. You've been listening to Hunter Wen of the American Federation of Musicians, Local 99, talking about the Portland Music Resiliency Expo. Like what you hear, if you find it useful, support KBOO, non-corporate, listener-supported, community-sponsored radio. Go to kboo.fm and make a contribution.
Another campaign of the local musicians union is around legislation related to musician status as independent contractors and the ways that large media corporations rip off musicians. Tell our listeners about the American Music Fairness Act and what AFM 99 is doing locally or in Oregon around independent contractor status.
Yeah, so the American Music Fairness Act is a piece of federal legislation that addresses a really simple yet disturbingly critical problem. And that's that radio stations don't pay royalties when they play artists' music in this country. Mind you, the United States is one of the only countries on the planet that still doesn't collect musician royalties for radio play. It's utterly absurd. And since most radio stations are owned by increasingly few corporations, there's really no excuse for using musicians' work without any compensation whatsoever. So the American Music Fairness Act would guarantee royalties to musicians for radio play, but it would also level the playing field as well, because it provides different pay structures for stations like KMHD, which is our local jazz station, or other small nonprofit educational radio stations like KBOO, for example, to make sure that they're not paying the same rates for those sorts of things. Addressing contractor status, whether it's locally or federally, is so difficult right now. The National Labor Relations Board, as we know, is effectively frozen solid where it's at. And so it's tough to fight for those sorts of things. Obviously, the Protecting the Right to Organize, or the PRO Act, would be revolutionary for musicians in particular because of this issue. But recently, we've directed our attention at raising the bar for musicians in other ways, namely, recently, with a push for prevailing wage legislation. Of course, a prevailing wage, for those who don't know, is a wage that's set by musicians in the industry. And specifically, what we're looking for is a prevailing wage for city-funded gigs. So it would ensure that no one plays for free or for pittance if the city of Portland is the one footing the bill, such as the Pioneer Square gigs, Music in the Park, those types of gigs. It exists in other industries, mostly in the building trades, for example, but music is so often an afterthought because it's a creative endeavor, right? Musicians are workers, and that needs to be said now and forever, and we need to treat them as such, just as we do for writers, for actors, and for stagehands. So to that end, We've actually been conducting a survey of freelance musicians on prevailing wage. And if your listeners want to participate in that survey, they can do so. The link is bit.ly/99prevwage. That's 99PREVWAGE.
All right. So there was a rally last week at Portland Community College protesting the elimination of the Music and Sonic Arts program. You spoke at that rally. What is the significance of this defeat for the local music scene?
Yeah, absolutely. So the focus of our union, as I mentioned, since the 1980s has been mostly orchestral, symphonic, and theatrical musicians, but our membership includes a ton of freelancers as well. And PCC Sonic Arts is so critical to many of the roles that support our members in the course of their work. A music teacher and ballet accompanist within membership here at 99 recently told me how important it is that young musicians understand the wide breadth of careers available to them in the music industry, because you don't just have to be an instrumentalist. You can be a sound engineer, or you can be somebody who works with a digital audio workstation, right? And Sonic Arts clearly serves that goal. And so to cut it, especially in the shady manner it seems that it was, is really a gut punch to the music ecosystem here in Portland. You know, this city makes so much money from music, and our public community college ought to reflect how valuable this industry really is. To give you an idea, the music industry in Portland, as was mentioned at the rally, pulls more revenue than cannabis. And let that sink in Portland, it pulls in more money than cannabis. We even heard at the rally how life-changing and even how life-saving this program is for many of the students in it. So to see it cut would just be, needless to say, such a disgrace.
As a member of the faculty union at Portland Community College, I really appreciate you speaking at that rally. So agree. It's really sad to see our education administrators not value that and our role in the music scene.
Yes, it's gross.
AFM 99 belongs to a number of local coalitions, including the Portland Theatrical Federation, Portland Jobs with Justice, Northwest Oregon Labor Council, Music First Coalition, and Healthcare for All Oregon. How are these coalitions important for local musicians?
So I say this a lot, and I'm going to say it again. Musicians are workers, and all workers deserve to be union workers, as I'm sure the two of you would agree. Many of our concerns in our industry are the same as other industries: low pay, unsafe working conditions, destruction of federal protections for workers, and so forth. So we try to stay active in our role as an advocate for Portland's musicians on a political level with these coalitions, not only for the benefit of our members, but for the benefit of music at large as an industry. Healthcare for All Oregon is obviously a no-brainer for the two of you. It's super important for musicians because most of them lack consistent employment and therefore healthcare coverage, or they have to purchase healthcare at incredible expense from the healthcare market. So I see a lot of value in musicians being informed about the music advocacy ecosystem, because it is out there. There's, you know, we certainly are not the only ones making noise about these sorts of issues, no pun intended, but our relationships with institutions like Music Portland, like the Music Policy Council in town, like Northwest Oregon Labor Council, and our relationships to members of Portland City Council now are incredibly important. So we don't silo our musicians away from their peers in labor or in politics, because we can all learn from each other when we work together, and oftentimes our issues are exactly the same.
Right. Well, see, so your website mentions several accomplishments, including musician loading zones, OLCC all ages shows, 100% smoke-free workplaces, minor entertainers, and KZME. What is the significance of these past victories?
They're incredibly significant to us. You know, as a union of about 550 members, we're very proud of what we've been able to accomplish with establishing free loading zones for musicians downtown, to encouraging more all-ages venues, the smoke-free workplaces, giving more places for minor entertainers to perform, and establishment of, you know, dedicated radio stations, obviously. We're very proud of those things. Loading zones, in particular, can be a huge expense and an annoyance for club and casual musicians, especially those who have to lug heavy equipment like a drum set. And, you know, those of us who have been around the block for a long time, excluding myself, of course, know what it was like to play in a very smoky bar, to play brass, let's say, in a smoky bar. Not fun. I can imagine not very fun. We have a continuing problem in this city of failing to serve our under 21 performers by not giving them enough places to play and to earn their stripes as musicians. So shout out to Friends of Noise. They're doing wonderful work on that very subject. These policy changes that we've fought for are the results of collective power in a group of workers that we've mentioned before are very hyper individualistic and often isolate themselves from their coworkers. They don't consider their peers their coworkers a lot of the time. Still, in my view, despite these victories, it's far from enough. Musicians in this town have such a unique set of challenges in order to just do their jobs. They have to be instrumentalists, most of them, but they also have to be sole proprietors, accountants, promoters, social media managers, and so much more just to scrape by collecting freelance gigs. So it's imperative that Local 99 not stop fighting for these winnable political victories, such as prevailing wage, as I've mentioned. We need to be honest that most of the musicians in this town are not members of our union. That's just a fact. So we can't ignore what they're collectively going through, and that's why we try to work on policy projects like these.
The local musicians union is also involved in several community service projects, like the Music Performance Trust Fund. Tell us about that.
Yes, the Music Performance Trust Fund, or MPTF, is particularly important here, and it's super exciting to talk about. It's not so much a community service as it is a direct result of strike negotiations. So to give some context, musicians across the country struck the record industry from 1942 to 1944 for nearly 2 years due to the threat of recorded music on their livelihoods. Before then, it was very common for musicians to be playing soundtracks to movies before talkies, or to have a live studio orchestra at NBC's radio station, for example. Kind of an eerie parallel to today's talk of AI replacing artists. A fun fact, during this time, a cappella music became very popular during the course of that strike, and one Frank Sinatra exploded in popularity because he continued to do recordings during the strike with a cappella musicians instead of instrumentalists. So Frank Sinatra was a scab, folks. One of the results of this nearly two-year strike was the establishment of a fund where a few pennies from every record that is sold and now streamed as of the last decade by major labels goes to pay musicians union wages, which is to say good wages, to perform gigs that are free and open to the public. It ensures that live music doesn't die, because the feeling back then was that live music would literally die. Nobody would ever listen to live music anymore because it was so much cheaper to just produce recorded music. So each local of the AFM, including ours, administers an allotment from MPTF every year to directly pay musicians to play free gigs that are open to the public. It's such a fantastic way for our members to secure good work. And the best part is the record industry is the one that's paying for it, right? And to think, it's just amazing to me when you think about it, that a strike that took place over 80 years ago is still paying dividends to musicians of today. So MPTF is one of the most important things that we take part in as a local.
Great. So Tuesday, September 9th, 6 to 9 p.m., you are hosting Portland Music Resiliency Expo at the AFM 99 Union Hall, which is at 325 Northeast 20th Avenue. Your promotion mentions prevailing wages, noise ordinance reform, artist spaces, and more. What should our listeners know about this event?
Yeah, so the Portland Music Resiliency Expo, as I've called it, is an effort to prepare ourselves for Live Nation and AEG, as I've mentioned. But further than that, it's an effort to start those conversations on improving wages, improving working conditions, adding additional protections for musicians in the freelance world, using the strengths that we have in numbers, in passion, and resistance. You know, Portland musicians, as I've learned over the last few years, are incredibly stubborn in the best way possible, and they're uncompromising self-starters. They care so much about things being grassroots, about being genuine. And so I hope that's what the expo can reflect. So as a labor organizer, my answer to this question of, what do we do moving forward in the freelance world, as it is with most questions, is to build resiliency and solidarity and power together as a collective. And that's why we're inviting all Portland musicians, regardless of where they come from, to attend the expo and directly join this movement for change, whether it be on noise code reform, which has had success recently, on building creative artist spaces downtown, setting prevailing wage for public gigs, or many other initiatives that do incredible work here in Portland to keep it such a vibrant music city. And I want it to be known that the expo is not just about talking about these issues and alluding to a solution, but it is the solution. We want to give musicians the opportunity to be an active part of the solution by signing them up at tables around the expo to work on specific policy initiatives. So I couldn't be more excited about it. And if your listeners want to RSVP for the Resiliency Expo, they can do so at bit.ly/PDXExpo. That's PDXEXPO. Super excited about this.
How can our listeners support your work, both musicians and allies, and how do we reach you?
Yeah, so if you make money as a musician, I think this is the most important. Know that the Musicians Union exists and that you're welcome here. We suffer from a severe lack of an advertising budget here at our local. So most people don't even know that they can be part of a union, even as a freelancer or somebody with inconsistent or part-time music work or doing six or seven different jobs as a musician. You are welcome in our union is what I want people to know more than anything. But in addition to that, if you live in the Portland metro area, if you're a musician, please attend the expo on the 9th. We're excited about it. We really want to get these things off the ground. We're hoping to build power all together and to bring advocates from many different policy working groups to build that momentum for change starting right now. And the more freelancers join our union or just engage with us at this event or at others in the future, the more collective power we can wield for that positive change.
Great. So that wraps it up for this evening's show. We've been listening to Hunter Buen, organizer with the American Federation of Musicians, Local 99. I'm Jamie Partridge with my co-host, Laura Wadlin. This is Labor Radio.